Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, Michael Brazel, and also the line we have Mr. Taylor Hammond Foster. Taylor, are you there?
I'm here. How you doing?
Doing great. So, internet's working, kinda. So if you hear me going in and out, just let me know, and I'll kick over to my cell phone. But we'll go with it as
Sounds
it is
good.
For the moment.
Sounds better than last time. So you're in the clear for now.
In the clear. I think we're doing like an hour tonight instead of our usual hour and a half, just to kind of test the system, just to be sure that. You know, I think anything, like I've noticed, if it goes past an hour, it usually like starts to fault out. So it's like we use all the internet in the house for the day.
Exactly. That's exactly how it works. Comcast doesn't want us on here too much.
Yeah. So we'll just kind of do like a reduced check-in. So if you do want to make donations to the show, you want to like, you know, support us, go to my website, michaelbrazel.com. You can always make a donation via the donate button at the bottom of my services page. And you can also schedule sessions and readings with me there. And all of my links are on that website too. And you can find Taylor at taylorhammondfoster.com. Of course, you can find us both on Facebook. And that's pretty much it for tonight. So we don't eat up too much time. And
short and sweet.
So before we get into tonight's topic, because, you know, we generally don't do topics, but tonight I felt like there were some good topics to talk about, some things that kind of came into my consciousness. So I figured we just would dive into those. So what's going on in your world before we dive too far into our topic?
It's the same old, same old. The school grind is coming to an end, 6 weeks and counting. So the countdown has begun, and more projects have been added to the list. But doing a lot of rock climbing and just trying to keep my head above the water with time management. So, but it's 6 weeks, so I'm pushing through it and kind of sacrificing some of my sanity for the end goal right now. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Awesome.
Yeah. How about you? How are things going there? I know you talk about getting some new things going in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, so we started to do the meditation group, and then, like, I had to take a break with it because the dogs all got diarrhea. So it's like puppy pads all over the house, you know. So it's kind of hard to do stuff here when you got puppy pads all over the house. But, yeah, still rolling with the usual stuff, just doing diet stuff, doing running almost every day. Going to be having some yoga opportunities pop up in D.C. when I'm there next time, so really diving back into the yoga practice. I actually started back up with a magical practice, too. I started taking fairy witchcraft training once again from another teacher, and it's going pretty good. Like, it feels
awesome.
Feels good to be back into that. So,
got no clue what that entails, so I'd like to know more about that, but
so like it's basically a witchcraft tradition that's based in embodiment. It's based in just getting into the body that comes with practice. It can be viewed as a shamanic practice in some ways. They're not afraid to talk about things like sex and the taboo topics. They're not afraid to step into their magic as a form of power, you know, and power meaning something that we can use to control the aspects of our own life. It's the thing I like most about the practice is it really helps us to take a look at ourselves through through a powerful lens. It lets us just kind of see where things are within our own bodies. It helps us to relate to our path with greater clarity because there's a lot of times we leave parts behind. We fragment ourselves. And when we are able to look at those fragmented pieces, we're able to then reassemble ourselves a little bit more whole. So it's a practice of not leaving anything out. It's how I can summarize.
Wow, I like that.
And it's very embodying. It's for me, it's a lot of practices take you out of the body. Like a lot of astral projection. Everyone wants to get out of the body, and this is a very much an in-the-body process. And, you know, we can do like a whole show on magical practices one day, but there are some things about it that I think are just beautiful. And the thing I like about it, too, it's everyone comes into it, and there are core practices that are shared among the different lines of this craft, but it's a very individualized practice within the stream of the line that you're in. So, like, everybody is powerful in their own space, but there are shared spaces that we all gather. And it's like you go to a family reunion and, like, everyone has different views on everything, but you're still sharing the same meal.
Yeah.
So it's like that.
Something I have to look into because I know nothing about it. And I was like, fairy magic? Are you doing making wands out of twigs? I don't
know. No, not like that. But the thing I like about it too is I can integrate it into, and I'm not like jumping into it into, like, I don't like labels. I don't like myself a witch. I'm not like putting the label of yogi on myself because I feel like one time I put a, like, even like the radio show that I do on my own on this channel, I don't like putting descriptives because it confines me. Like, I'm not a witch, like, in a sense. I don't celebrate the wheel of the year. Like, I don't do the Sabbats. I don't practice those. Like, I'm not even a good Christian because I don't practice, like, the holidays, you know? So I don't like wearing labels. I just like the practice of engaging my body, my mind, and my soul in a way that lets me feel more embodied so that I can take that to my clients and students so that they can become more empowered.
Like that's the point for all of it, like any of these practices. I feel like that's the underlying message that so many people are trying to say, but we just get caught up with there's these steps that we have to take in order to, like, fit into these different groups just because of various traditions and the ways that things have been done for so long. So I think nowadays we're getting the opportunity to kind of cherry pick those ideas and those practices that help us as individuals, but not feel like we have to be stuck down to one practice and one group of people, essentially.
Right. It's like, you know, even like within yoga, it's like, I read the Bhagavad Gita like once, you know, but I'm not like, it's not the thing that informs the practice that I'm in. One day I came to the realization that I've read like bits and pieces of all these things and bits and pieces have stuck, but I've never identified with like any of it. Like, I don't identify with the Yoga Sutras and all the precepts, like the yamas and niyamas. I understand them. I know what they are, but it's not like something I go about daily trying to embody. Like, for me, my practice has always been very organic. It's been what I feel to be true. So when I've tried to constrict myself into a label, I find that I rebel, like my body rebels. It's like,
stop practicing.
It's like saying, fuck you, and this like thing you think you're about to do. We're not doing that. Like, and the minute I put the label yogi on myself, it's like everything has to be about yoga, and then it comes at the exclusion of everything else. And it's like, Well, if I do that, then I'm excluding all these very powerful magical practices that have been part of my experience for so long. Or if I do that, then I'm excluding this thing. And now I'm looking at a more inclusive way of moving through my own spirituality, but making it my own. And the thing I like about this line of fairy that I am embarking in is the teacher really encourages that self-identification within the framework of what we're doing collectively. So basically, it's about self-possession. You possess yourself with these tools, and you shape the tools to you versus you trying to shape yourself to the tools. And it's nice that way, because then you can see what works and you can modify it to add it into your practice. Like for me, my yoga practice is how I move through ritual. Like I don't like have asanas, and I don't have like those things, you know. I just don't do tools. For me, tools, I don't need this tool to engage in the psychodrama of going to see God herself. I just can just go. You know, I can dance the Shiva in the cremation grounds. And I can, you know, visit Kali and, like, play ping pong with skulls and stuff. You know, I don't need to like, you know, sprinkle water and, like, do these things. I just go. And every now and then I will do the ritualistic, you know, casting of the circles and those things. But it's very rare. For me, like, the minute I step into the space, the energy just shifts itself. You know, I don't like it to be complicated.
Now,
like,
has that been something like an approach that you've gone about since you can, like, for as long as you can remember with your spiritual practice, or is that something that's developed over time where you might have early on done the practice and done the rituals and kind of followed those structures a little bit stronger when first learning about them? Or have you always just kind of had like you try to stay away from those?
I've always had an affinity for rebellion.
I don't relate to that.
I mean, just look at my face. Right? Like, I have an affinity for rebellion. I don't do well with constriction. And I don't do well when something becomes absolute. Like, for instance, I was taking communion that I didn't know you were supposed to say, like, and they say in the body of Christ, you're supposed to say amen. I just thought, like, I just go up and get it. Like, I thought that's what I was supposed to. I was like, I didn't feel like I was making an offering to divine. I felt the divine was making an offering to me.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, and like, some, once some, like, I got this new tattoo, which is a voodoo symbol. And this person was like, oh, you got to be careful when you put that symbol on you because, you know, you're calling in the gods. And I'm like, no, the gods asked me to put this tattoo on me. I didn't, like, petition the deity. She came to me and said, would you be willing to wear my marker? And of course, there it is. So I think there's a misconception that we go to them for power. They oftentimes show up in our lives. Like, Shiva showed up to me during a ritual. Like, I never sought Shiva out. I didn't know who Shiva was. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing Shiva. And, like, and I've researched him, and, like, he's, like, my main deity. Like, he Christ and Buddha, and then behind them, like, Kali and the Morrigan are, like, my main deities that I work with. And I'm okay with that. I don't need anything else. Like for me, that's it. You know? And, like, I try to read the Bhagavad Gita and go into it, but then, you know, it's like, it's Krishna, and Krishna's just not my dude, you know? So.
Just doesn't ring with you.
It doesn't. It doesn't resonate. My body, like, shuts down every time I try to read it.
I totally understand how that is.
But it's like, then you start creating and crafting your own practice instead. Like, I've already gotten back into Reiki. Like, I put Reiki on the shelf for a while. And now, like, everyone's wanting Reiki. So I've really gotten back into reformatting how I teach it and making it more an embodied, intuitive practice versus just a healing practice. So I'm teaching it a little bit differently now.
That's awesome. And you're going to be doing some classes when you're up in D.C., you were saying?
Yeah, I'm going to do some Reiki intensives. I'm going to be doing some shows on this channel specifically geared towards Reiki also, and doing some Reiki meditations. One, to help people who've lost track of where Reiki is to come back to it. and then for those who aren't Reiki attuned, to give them the experience of Reiki through the radio transmission. But even I'm noticing my intuitive work is moving more towards the healing aspect than it is to just giving people information. I'm finding I don't like just doing informational stuff. Like, I'm just really like getting on my nerves.
Caught on to that. Well, you want people to get involved with their own lives. Like, your goal isn't to be the person that other people necessarily rely on, but rather be the person that can help people rely on themselves.
Right.
Give them, pass the tools that you've learned on to other people.
Right, especially when it comes like to relationships and those kinds of things. And I really don't mind doing like relationship questions, but what I find is people are asking me questions and they're looking for me to give them some kind of out or some kind of in. And I'm not going to wear that narrative for them in that respect. I'm going to challenge them in that relationship and in the questions they're asking me. So when they come to me for things, I'm like, be ready, because it's not me giving you answers. I'm going to be asking you questions to figure out what you're really trying to ask me. When people are asking about stuff, they're not really asking that question. There's a deeper question, and I'm going to rip those Band-Aids off until we get to that question. It's not going to be pretty.
Yeah. And I think that's why I like talking with you so much when we first met at the shops a couple of years back. Like, it was, yes, I came in there, and I kind of had some questions to things, but you kind of kicked it off with just sending the questions back to us. Like, why are you looking for this stuff? Why are you interested in this stuff? And then through our conversations there, it kind of evolved.
Right. Right. And what I'm finding is it's more important to not coddle weakness. And that's one of the tenets in fairy too, is to not coddle weakness. And what I'm finding is if I can empower someone, they're less likely to come back for the same thing, and now we get to do the real work of refinement and integration. And that's where I feel the work is of much greater value, is when we're integrating our spirituality with our mundane experience. We're realizing the sacredness in everything through the experience of dialogue or through healing work or whatever else comes of the practice. But I'm finding, like, I'm looking, like, as I teach integration, I'm finding myself integrating more. And that's where the fairy practices come back up, because they were an important part of my path, and I left them at a time where I didn't feel as connected to the line that I was in, and then I didn't feel connected to the space I was in, and plus my intuition was getting me geared up towards a big life change. So it started to cut the things away that would have posed a challenge to me making the transition. But I'm grateful that I started off with the teacher I had. She was amazing. I learned a lot of stuff, and that stuff is helping me now in my current study path. So I love it. Like, I actually, we did some radio shows in the archives on fairy tradition, and we interviewed the teacher that I was with, Karina Blackheart, and that interview is in the archives. If you want to go and like listen to what fairy is all about, she gives a pretty good rundown of it in that interview. But
definitely have to look into it.
Shifting into the topic tonight, and I actually thought this would be a good topic for you too. Over the weekend, I watched a couple really powerful documentaries. The most powerful one I watched was a movie called How to Die in Oregon. And in Oregon, they have
heard of this.
It's great doc. I mean, such a good documentary. And they talk about, what most people call doctor-assisted suicide. But the term they prefer to use is dying with dignity. And I like that term because I feel like that's what it is. But in reality, it is. It's suicide. But it's for people who have terminal illness. And they would rather leave the body on their own terms, rather than waiting till they reach the end of their
degenerate trauma into nothingness. For their bodies to, at least.
Right. So it was an interesting movie to watch, because these people really let you into their lives, but also into their transitions. Like, that you actually get to witness the transitions, like in the documentary.
Wow.
And it was a tearjerker. Total tearjerker. because it makes you question your own, like, what would you do? Like, what would you do if you knew you had, like, Hodgkin's lymphoma or, you know, leukemia or something where there was no return?
Yeah.
And one of the points to bring in the movie that I thought was beautiful was that a lot of times we assume that the greater the suffering, the greater the dignity.
Yeah, like, we see that a lot.
Like, you can do this. Like, stay strong. And what I saw in the movie was, like, making that decision is a very strong thing to do because it's not easy. A lot of people look at it like a cop-out. You know, why are you leaving so soon? Like, they might find a cure or a miracle or something could happen, you know, and it's like, really, you know, is that really going to happen? You know, I think sometimes we hold on, like, to the hope that, and this is one of those moments where hope can be a dangerous thing because holding on to the hope of a cure for something that you only have like 6 months to go can end up causing more suffering than making the choice to leave on your own terms. And I think only two states right now allow for death with dignity.
Dying with dignity.
Yeah.
Which would it be? Oregon and...
Washington.
Okay.
Washington State. So, like, what are your thoughts on it? Like, what do you feel you would do? What would be your thought process if you were posed with these options?
With that question?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, I think that's a really, really hard question to answer. I mean, it really depends on so many circumstances. It depends on, like, I mean, the only way that it would come into question for me is if it's a disease, something that's degenerative and that's going to kill me in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, it's if I choose to try and fight it with medications, is that going to, like, ruin my quality of life, or is that going to happen anyways? Am I just going to drop dead one day, or is it going to be a slow decline where I'm eventually bedridden for weeks? And I mean, I think that it's all circumstantial. I think that if I'm going to have like 6 months to live, and even two out of those 6 months are going to be stuck bedridden, my legs aren't going to work, and I'm going to be shitting into a bag, I think that I'd want to have it on my terms. If I feel like I'm ready to go at that moment, then
mm-hmm.
I should have the right over my own body to do that.
Right.
I mean, I think that when you really get down into it, it's just like the issue with drugs. People are, like, illegal drugs right now. Like, people are trying to control our, like, other people's consciousness. If it's only affecting our physical body, we should have the choice to do what we want to it. And I understand that's hard when it seems destructive or if it's literally ending your life, but it still comes down to being our individual choice.
Mm. Yeah, it's not an easy one to make.
No, not at all. Not by any means. And I'm not, like, that's, I think, a big stressor for me, is that it's so circumstantial, and that you just don't. I think that from my perspective, it's like, if there's a chance to fix it, take that chance. And if that doesn't work and there's still more time left and your body's still holding on, even if you're feeling like you've finished the fight and there's not actually any real hope of anything happening, it's just going to be, you got a few more weeks left, like, say goodbye to everyone. I think that's the point where you can kind of say your goodbyes and choose when you want to go. There's no reason to suffer through it for those weeks.
Right.
And put your family through that also. I mean, seeing you suffer and you degrade from this person that that people loved and cared about to someone that everyone's just feeling sorry for and crying for the last months of your life. Like, mm-hmm. those are going to be the last memories, are going to be the memories that they, that they're going to hold on to quite, for quite a while.
Right.
For those to be a few decrepit and terribly sick and miserable in bed, I don't think that that's something that I'd want people to remember me as.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was watching it, I was thinking, you know, what I would do. And I thought about this before, because I think about things mm-hmm. like this. Because
yeah.
I'm just creepy like that. But I do think about death a lot, because it's a reality. And if we're not
yeah.
thinking about death, we should be, because, and I'm not saying obsessed about death, but we should understand our mortality and the very fact that it's, our lives are finite. And this is why, like, for me, it's been so much more important to integrate, because I feel if you're not living an authentic experience, then what are you waiting for? If you're not doing
yeah.
everything that makes you happy, and you're not living in the purity of your own experience, then what are you waiting for? Like, if you're not writing poetry, what are you waiting for? If you're not telling your story, what are you waiting for? If you're not doing magic, what are you waiting for? If you're not doing yoga, what are you waiting for? If you're not eating delicious foods, what are you waiting for? And I think, and that's just why when I was watching this movie, watching the decision-making process, and what they would do is they would get the prescription, they would have the drugs, and it's not like they had to take them. So it's like if you get them, you have to do, leave that way. Like, you still have the option
yeah,
of
no.
ending however you want. And I don't want people to think like one is better than the other, because everyone has to make their own choice. And I
yeah.
just feel like we should have the choice. And
exactly. The choice is the most important part, just having that option and doing it in a dignified way.
Right. And I feel that it's very empowering to be able to grieve while you're still here, and giving your family the power to grieve with you. You know,
mm-hmm.
because usually when we're holding on to hope, like even in the hospital, people will stay on life support for months and they just won't be in the body. You know?
Yep.
And we're clinging to the idea of the body as the individual. So when I look at the choice, I look at it, what's gonna be best for me? Because it really is on some level about my family, but it really isn't, you know?
No, it's down to
and
you.
I shouldn't remain in the suffering just to make them feel better. And one of the ladies in the documentary said, like, her deal was that she would go until the suffering was just unbearable and that she was going to become a burden to her family. Then that's when she would decide to leave. Because you're going to go either way.
Yep.
So you can go to the fullness of the illness, which in the last few weeks you're probably not going to be present anyways. And as the body
yeah.
begins to shut down process and it begins to pull itself back into itself, as the soul begins to transition from the body begins that shutdown phase. And it was just so beautiful to watch these people. And it really just really hits you, because you see how powerful it is to leave on your own terms. And like, they were singing songs to their family, and like, they were saying thank you to everybody. It's like, and even as the drugs are putting them to sleep, they were saying like, thank you. Like, their whole prayer, like the whole, like all of the last breaths that they had were used in gratitude. Like, it was just like such a beautiful thing to witness, because there was so much dignity in that. You
yeah.
know, it's like, and like, they were just like, they just fall asleep and that's it. You know, and as painful as it is, what I witnessed in that exchange was such gratitude all around. It's like the suffering that is usually amplified by the attachment of hope wasn't there. It's like
yeah.
we just got to experience this together, you know, and it was very empowering to watch, you know. And of course, it brought up a lot of other things too. Like, one of the ladies was like, didn't patch things up with her mother, and she said in something pretty profound. She says, "Death doesn't mean having to leave everything perfect."
Wow.
And I was like, wow, like what? Like, that's something like you don't even realize until you're in that space. you don't have to leave it. Like we work so hard. Like there's times when I'm like looking at my own practice. I'm like, I gotta really get this stuff down. I gotta write this book. I gotta finish this. And it's like, no, you don't. You know,
you can, but you don't have to.
It's like it's not that important. You know, but enjoying the process is, like, enjoying everything and just coming to terms with everything. That's what's important.
Yeah.
Because if you had a finite amount of days left, like, how would you spend those days, you know? Like,
exactly.
What really becomes important? It's like, it was witness, powerful. She was giving her stuff away. She was just doing these very powerful things, you know, and it starts to make you question your own mortality in the sense of how you're living right now. Like, if you were to leave this earth tomorrow, what would the stuff you leave behind say about you? You know?
Yeah.
Like, what do you leave with your legacy? What do you leave behind?
Right now, it's a tornado of anxiety in a messy room.
Right.
But that's sounds like it opens up a lot of big questions, this movie.
It does. I think it does. I think they're necessary questions, because I think there are times when we as individuals don't come to terms with the fact that we're dying and that we don't have forever and that we don't know what's on the other side and that all that's okay. But I think once we understand how death works, that we can taste life a little bit better. You know, life tastes better when you know it's not the last trip. You know, you get to just savor it a little bit. Like, you know, it's like people like, it's like, you know, now these little puppies all got sick, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you look at them, you're like, they're not going to be here forever. You know?
Yeah.
So it put me into a mode where you look at how frustrating it is to get up like at 3 a.m. because I got to go outside and, you know, whatever. But it's
mm-hmm.
like, I'm so grateful that I am chosen in this moment to be here to like take care of them and to, you know, clean their bottoms before they come inside, you know, and to, you know, wake up at 4 a.m. to walk outside with them. Like, how grateful I am to have that, because like one day they're not going to be here. You know? And I have to, like, one day I'm not going to be here, you're not going to be here, and like we'll be able to do this radio show anymore, you know. It's like we forget that things are just so finite, you know. And I hope that by opening up discussion around death and dying, that we come to the realization that everything is so precious and so sacred.
Yeah, and I think Pat's doing an amazing job with like showing us that.
Yeah.
I mean, with the amount of like love and affection that you get from pets, and for such a finite amount of time, like, you know, when you have a dog or cat, you've got like between 10 and 15 years usually max, and that's about it.
Right.
So you kind of, as much as I don't like to look at it this way, but when I remember early on, I was pretty young when my first dog died, and we got my second one after that. And like within a year of that, I kind of realized how quickly he was going to be gone. Like, I thought about how old my last dog was and realized, like, and thought about where I was going to be 10, 11, 12 years from there. And that's where I am now. So I'm kind of at that point where dogs are getting really old, and you're seeing it and noticing it, and especially being away from home, it's like every time that you're back home and you see them, you realize how much they matter to you and how much you care about them. But then you also realize that this might be the last time that you get to spend time with them.
Right.
And it's like every time I have to kind of go through that saying goodbye process, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
With them when they're at this age and when they're starting to get health issues and having trouble walking and can't see and all that. And it's hard, but at the same time, it's also been pretty rewarding being able to basically gives me an opportunity to reflect back on all of the good and all the positive moments that I've had with them, and how much I really do enjoy having him there with me when I do, mm-hmm. and taking, like, appreciating that and not taking it for granted.
Right. Awesome.
Yeah.
It's important. It's important for us to, and for me, I've also found myself wanting to understand how the healing practice that I'm engaged in serves in those moments that are leading up to our transition from living into dying and from dying into death. So I felt drawn to go and, like, do hospice work and, like, volunteer in hospice and stuff. So it's something that I'm exploring, like, because I'm very experiential. I don't just want to be – because I got to witness my aunt passing from cancer. But now having tools that I can use to help ease transition and to provide whatever can be provided for in those spaces is important. So, you know, for me, it's just maybe, like, woke up a part of me that felt like – that's where I could be of service. So
yeah.
It shifted my worldview a bit. But real quick, another documentary I saw, so we're going to shift gears a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this was a more tougher conversation to have, I think. But it was about late-term abortions. So
abortions
that are done in the third trimester.
Okay.
So basically,
what's that
almost,
movie called?
Oh God, hold on. okay, hold on a second. So what are your thoughts on abortion? So as I look up this documentary,
that's a tough one for me. Mostly because, as I don't know, I kind of take the approach that as the man in the situation and always having straight, like, heterosexual relationships, if a girl that I'm with gets pregnant, ultimately I do have a say in it, but it's ultimately her decision. Mm-hmm. So it's like, despite my moral or personal beliefs, I don't have the end choice in it. I can't force her to do anything that she doesn't want to regarding it. And so that kind of, that approach makes me just lean towards just being, it's, everyone needs to have the choice. It's, if they can go through with it emotionally and physically, I think that they should, and that there's good adoption programs. But I think that if they feel that it's not going to be something that they can handle, whether it's not the right time and it's going to affect their futures in a career sense, or it's going to affect their futures in a personal sense and emotional sense, I think that they need to have the decision to choose when to terminate the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you start talking about late term abortions, where, like, I don't know, I think that's where it gets a little bit dicier. I mean, if it's a medical issue and it's going to be detrimental to your health and possibly life-threatening for the mother or the baby, I think that a decision can be made to end it then. But I think that if it's just at an inconvenience, I think that there does need to be some kind of arbitrary date, if that makes sense.
Well, there is, like, a date that they can't go past because it would be too far beyond term. I think at 21 weeks is, like, the cutoff for but, you know, when we start talking about convenience or inconvenience, it's like how do we define that? Because, you know, I can totally, like I agree with you too, like, I, especially as a gay male, like, don't feel like my opinion is one that I want to throw in the ring because it's not my decision. Like, I'm not pro-life or pro-choice. I'm pro-woman.
Yeah.
I'd rather her make the decision.
Like, describe it.
You know, I trust in her ability to attune to her own body, to make a decision based on how her body needs to be respected in whatever way it needs to be respected. Like, I don't feel like I have a choice in that matter, just like she wouldn't have necessarily have a choice in the matters of my body. But, you know, when it comes to late term, there's always the question, especially in the Christian argument, as to when the soul enters the body. Because that's when they say it becomes human and not just a microorganism of some sort. You know, we start talking about like things like illness and long-term care of a child that's going to be suffering as it enters the world. And in the documentary too, because this is something I really hadn't thought about. Like, you know, you really don't get to see behind the curtain when a woman goes in to make those decisions.
No.
And the movie opened up that curtain. And like,
oh wow.
And it was just like this other documentary. These are tough choices that these individuals are making, and you can't understand it because you're not in their shoes. Like, you just can't. Like, you can only empathize to a point, but
yeah.
Especially the man, like, I'll never be able to understand what that is like to make that decision. Just like I haven't been diagnosed with some terminal illness, so I'm not going to know what it's like to make that decision until I'm in that space, you know? And hopefully I won't be, but if I am, you know, it'll still be through my own perspective and not through someone else's lens. So the documentary was great in that it let me see something that I would normally had never seen. And it was called After Tiller. And Dr. Tiller was an abortion specialist, a late-term abortion specialist that was murdered by a Christian who felt
okay.
He was doing God's work by murdering this doctor. And there's only three other doctors in the world now. There's four doctors now who do late-term abortion. Just because
wow.
Other doctors are so terrified to get into that space, because at that point, really, it is a baby. Like, when the baby is aborted from the body, it is a baby. Like,
yeah.
it's almost, you know, looks just like a baby. But when they showed the process that these mothers have to go through, again, it, like, rips at your heart, because you realize this is not, like, they're just not making this decision because, you know, they're willy-nillying it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's still up to the doctor's discretion as to if they do it. So they have to make the final decision if they're going to do the procedure or not. So it's like these doctors are put in these positions where they have to make these very powerful decisions in regards to the story that women are bringing them. So it's a lot of weight on everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and not a happy position to be in for anyone, because it's a tough topic. It's tough. They're uneasy. There are no easy choices and no easy answers. And it's not an easy process, to have to go through or witness, but it was something that this documentary allowed me to see that I would have never been privy to. And it shifted my worldview, because it's not a topic that I'd been, you know, witnessed it. Like, where else would I have seen that if it had not been for this documentary?
Yeah, exactly. It just isn't in your space of consciousness.
Right. It's just not something I would normally. It was this documentary has been there forever, and I was like, well, let me see what this is all about. And I put it on. It was on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, like, opened my worldview. It opened up this curtain, and they were brutally honest. They gave both perspectives in the documentary. So it wasn't like they were like pro, go out and do this. They were like, understand what these people are going through when they come into the clinic. This is not like they're coming in just to abort the baby. Like, this is a
yeah.
very trying emotional experience for these women. And understand that when you're yelling at them outside the clinic as they're going in, like, you're amplifying the amount of shame they're already experiencing, you know?
Yeah.
And it was good. It was interesting to see. But it kind of brings me to, like, as we've got the last 15 minutes here, it brings to the third topic, which I thought would be really great for you to talk on, is the power of film. You know,
oh, wow.
And you know, how film shifts our worldview, and how documentaries such as these, like, really brought me over the past couple of weeks into realms I may have heard of, but haven't really gotten to experience in a way that created visceral change for me. because unless you're going into hospice care, where else are you going to experience, unless you live in Oregon even, like, you would not even really, this idea may not even be in your spectrum. Like, until I watched the documentary, I was like, well, maybe I'll, I mean, if I got something, I the choice for me at that moment was, do I use medicines in the end, or do I feel the full suffering of the illness?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I was thinking about. When I saw this documentary, I'm like, hell, we're moving to Oregon. You know, because I don't want a choice, you know? And,
exactly.
Yeah. So what do you feel is the responsibility of film in helping to open up or close down our perspectives on various aspects of life?
Well, I mean, just like the topics that we're talking about, everything is so circumstantial. And I think that documentary and narrative film, although often considered very different, I think that they're still very much the same thing. Like you said, like, you can have a life-changing, like, shift in your perspective just based on a film, whether it be Shawshank Redemption or it be Dying in Oregon. Like, when we watch these movies, I love the idea of when we watch film, I forget who said it. He said something along the lines of, when we watch a film, we understand it truly because we've been programmed from the beginning to comprehend films because of it's no different than watching our dreams. So it's seeing these moving images, seeing these kind of pictures flashing across the screen feel real enough to us that we can connect with it emotionally, is kind of what I get with that.
Mm-hmm.
When someone's telling you a story or someone's talking about a story or talking about an experience, it's only got that one aspect, that just the language that they're speaking in. It doesn't give the pictures, the images, the faces of the people going through these things, the reactions of the people that are against them trying to accomplish these things. When we get all of these visual stimulation mixed in with the story being told, I think that it resonates with us so much stronger that it can actually have, like you said, like, it can have a conscious shifting change in our lives. And I think the documentary is working towards that. I think that we getting, like, pulled into films, especially, like, really bright, action-packed, and kind of with fancy camera movements and really engaging as an engaging art form. I think that we get that in narrative film, and I think that we're starting to see more of that in documentary film, that style of filmmaking, which kind of brings us into that space of absorbing the character's feeling a little bit more than we normally would. And I love that. That's what excites me so much about film and the future, especially in documentary film, that we're seeing this kind of emergence of the two styles, but still being true to facts and what you're, what the filmmaker's seeing, but just being able to portray that in a way that we're now able to connect with even stronger. It's not just that science video that you have to watch that's like, this is a fact. This is why this is. Here is another fact for half an hour that we got in science class back in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that now that we can engage with the content, we can connect with the content.
Right. Right. I like that. And I think, too, that now, since everyone has, you know, ability to record, nothing to YouTube, you know, there's so much more documentation happening. But for me, I love the fact that documentaries, like the ones I watched, aren't afraid to breach these spaces of taboo. You know, I think it does take a lot for the filmmaker to want to enter that space because it's not going to be a popular space to enter. Like, another great documentary I saw was one on the Phelps family, people from the Westboro Baptist Church.
Oh, okay.
And this guy went in and they let him into their lives. And you actually see them as normal people. And for me, it was a really powerful documentary because it humanized them. you know, and you realize that this other half, this other part of them is just a sliver of who they actually are. And, you know, just like that sliver of us that they are really hating, whatever that choice hate thing is for that day, is just a sliver of what they're reflecting back to themselves by looking at us, you know? So it's when you get to see people as human and not as the signs they're carrying and the epitaphs they're screaming at us and the Bible verses they're thumping, it lets you, it gives you an opportunity to change your perspective on them as people. And then I may not respect what they're doing as Christians, and I may not respect what they're doing as members of society when they're engaging in those practices, but when I look at them as just like a family, like at a gathering, or like, you know, just like, you know, being silly teenagers, like some of the kids where they watch some of the kids doing like these, what normal everyday kids do, you start to see like we are not always the masks that we wear. And I think it's important, you know, and I would never have seen that. Like, I would never have gotten that perspective had it not been for the documentary I saw.
And that's where documentaries are awesome, because it takes these ideas that we're seeing just glimpses of in the news in these like short little 3-minute sound bites that we're getting from CNN and Fox and NBC and even alternative media. It's still down to sound bites. It's still a 3-minute little clips like talking about a big issue that you cannot get to the bottom line in 3 minutes. And that's, I mean, documentary film is doing an awesome job with that these days. We're getting inside looks into all these things that are happening. Snowden documentary, the new Scientology documentary, these documentaries that you talked about tonight. Like, all of these are taking big issues that have been kind of brushed on in the news, but really hasn't been, like, we haven't really dived into them before the documentaries came out. And I think that that's what we're seeing. We're basically in a world where nowadays news articles come out, little 3-minute thing, kind of piques people's interest, and then it's the responsibility of filmmakers to then, as soon as we hear about these things that pique our interest, it's our responsibility to go and figure out more, to learn more, and to share that information with other people. Dive into these topics that are only brushed upon and look at both sides of it. Give an actual objective like representation of what's happening, or as objective as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And try and show as many sides of the story as possible when we have the opportunity to. And that's what excites me about it. And where I think that there's going to be a lot of benefit.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's great that we can have that peek behind the curtain into topics and ideas and areas of life that we normally would never have gotten a chance to witness. And but even like when I worked at PETA, there's a really great documentary that came out called Earthlings that really put powerfully images with music with story, and it created this powerful narrative on the suffering of animals. And I also remember there was another movie that came out called I Am Animal, a documentary that was about PETA, and I was in it. So it was kind of so I was actually in a documentary. And they were filming me Leaflet in New York, and like I remember – like watching it, like they were filming us like pass out flyers, which can be either really exciting or it can be really boring, you know? It was like right around Thanksgiving. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were doing like the whole Butterball campaign, because Butterball, you know, viciously abuses and tortures their animals. But one thing people didn't know is they were also sexually assaulting the turkeys.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we were passing out these flyers, and like no one was taking my flyer. I was like, "Oh shit!" Like no one's gonna take flyers. And we had like a TV screen with the images of slaughter and the abuse playing like on this body TV. And I was like, "Well, what can I do?" And I was like, "Butterball rapes turkeys." You know, and everybody stopped in their tracks.
Yeah, everyone's gonna pay attention to that one.
And you're like, what? You know? So that's what you see in the documentary, is me like, I think it's either, Butterball sexually abuses turkeys, or Butterball like rapes turkeys or something. But it shows us like everyone taking leaflets, because at that point everyone wanted to know what the hell was going on. But it was just kind of neat to, be part of the experience of being on the other side of the camera, in a
Yeah.
documentary. But to watch how they wove the narrative together, because they filmed this like over, I think it was a year, year and a half, 2 years maybe. And to
Yeah,
watch it all come
absolutely.
together into a film, you're like, wow, that's pretty cool. It's like the film only lasts like an hour and some change, But like how
All the
they,
work that goes into it.
and how they wove that whole story into something that was well done and like something that gets a real powerful message across. But then too, the other side is like documentaries can be used to sway narrative like to a certain agenda.
Yeah. Whether it be a good agenda or bad agenda, that's not really our decision to make, but it's like it's going to happen. And that's what
Right.
I was saying before, with saying as objectively as possible. Like, one of the big debates, especially in documentary, is can you truly be objective? Even with cinema verite, fly on the wall cinema, where it's just someone posts up with a camera and just lets it run for hours on end and tries to stay out of it as much as possible. Are they truly being objective, or is the camera just being in the room affecting how people behave? And I think
Right.
that's a big question with documentary filmmaking nowadays, is can you be objective? Is it even worth trying to be objective? And how do you tell both sides of the story as well as possible, if that's even your goal?
Right. So we only got a few minutes left here, but I just want to ask you just one quick question. It's kind of a wrap-up question. Is like, what do you, as a film student and as someone who is, really in tune with this, this form of accessing consciousness, how do you hope to see it evolve? Like, how do you hope to see how we're telling like these narratives evolve? Like, what are your hopes in the future for film?
I want to see more interaction, like with the films, and then when the films come out, I want to see more dialogue happening for each individual film. So,
How would you want to see that?
there's so many different ways. The one that just comes to me off the top of my head right now is, have you ever been on SoundCloud, the
Yeah.
music streaming site? And you can see how like people can comment at a specific point.
Right.
And you can choose to read the comments if you want to, or you can choose to have them pop up automatically.
Right.
I think something like that, and having like, I think that documentary films especially should host online like Ustream sessions, so they can offer their film for free for like, come to this URL at this time, and then they can have discussions going on at the same time. Because
Wow.
right now people are doing that, but it's like, have us host a screening in your neighborhood, and it's like it
Right.
relies on people finding space and time to do that. And I want to see that come to the internet. I want to see
Right.
the discussions happen in real time, and I want to see more of them,
Right.
because I think a lot of documentaries call for change, and then they leave it up to the viewers to do it on their own time. And I think that if we
Right.
can make that happen quicker and more efficiently, I think that that's going to be the greatest achievement with it.
Excellent. All right, folks, we're down to the last little few minutes here, or minute actually. We thank you for joining us. Like short edition tonight. Hopefully by next week, things worked out great tonight, so we'll go back up to our next, our usual 90-minute stream. Who knows what we'll talk about next week? We'll just kind of play
Who
around, see
knows?
what comes up. Who knows? Anyways, thank you all for joining us. Anything you want to say as we close out?
Have a good night, and I want everyone to make something.
Make
Create.
something. Create. Do something beautiful for yourself and for the world right now. Right now, go do it. Whatever that is. All right. So next week we'll have some creation. We'll bring creation. We're each gonna write a poem. I'm each gonna read a poem on air next week. So.
Awesome.
All right. Have a
Love
great
it.
night, everyone.
Have a good night.
Namaste.